The Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo. Continuing with Part 1, The Yoga of Divine Works, and Chapter 10, The Three Modes of Nature, bottom of page 236. An escape from the action of the two inferior gunas is very evidently indispensable if we are to transmute our present nature into a power and form of the divine consciousness and an instrument of its forces. Tamas obscures and prevents the light of the divine knowledge from penetrating into the dark and dull corners of our nature. Tamas incapacitates and takes away the power to respond to divine impulse and the energy to change and the will to progress and make ourselves plastic to a greater Shakti. Rajas perverts knowledge, makes our reason the accomplice of falsehood and the abettor of every wrong movement, disturbs and twists our life force and its impulses, oversets the balance and health of the body. Rajas captures all high-born ideas and high-seated movements and turns them to a false and egoistic use. Even divine truth and divine influences, when they descend into the earthly plane, cannot escape this misuse and seizure. Tamas, unenlightened, and Rajas, unconverted, no divine change or divine life is possible. An exclusive resort to sattva would seem to be the way of escape. But there is this difficulty, that no one of the qualities can prevail by itself against its two companions and rivals. If, envisaging the quality of desire and passion as the cause of disturbance, suffering, sin, and sorrow, we strain and labor to quell and subdue it, Rajas sinks, but Tamas rises. With the principle of activity dulled, inertia takes its place. A quiet peace, happiness, knowledge, love, right sentiment can be founded by the principle of light, but if Rajas is absent or completely suppressed, the quiet in the soul tends to become a tranquility of inaction, not the firm ground of a dynamic change. Ineffectively right thinking, right doing, good, mild, and even the nature may become in its dynamic parts sattva tamasic, neutral, pale-tinted, uncreative, or emptied of power. Mental and moral obscurity may be absent, but so are the intense springs of action, and this is a hampering limitation and another kind of incompetence. For tamas is a double principle. It contradicts rajas by inertia, it contradicts sattva by narrowness, obscurity, and ignorance, and if either is depressed, it pours in to occupy its place. If we call in rajas again to correct this error and bid it ally itself to sattva and by their united endeavor to get rid of the dark principle, we find that we have elevated our action, but that there is again subjection to rajas eagerness, passion, disappointment, suffering, anger. These movements may be more exalted in their scope and spirit and action than before, but they are not the peace, the freedom, the power, the self-mastery at which we long to arrive. Wherever desire and ego harbor, passion and disturbance harbor with them and share their life. And if we seek a compromising between the three modes, sattva leading, the others subordinate, still we have only arrived at a more temperate action of the play of nature. A new poise has been reached, but a spiritual freedom and mastery are not in sight, or else are still only a far-off prospect. A radically different movement has to draw us back from the gunas and lift us above them. The era that accepts the action of the modes of nature must cease. For as long as it is accepted, the soul is involved in their operations and subjected to their law. Sattva must be transcended as well as rajas and tamas. The golden chain must be broken no less than the leaden fetters and the bond ornaments of a mixed alloy. The Gita prescribes to this end a new method of self-discipline. It is to stand back in oneself from the action of the modes and observe this unsteady flux as the witness, seated above the surge of the forces of nature. He is one who watches, but is impartial and indifferent, aloof from them on their own level and in his native posture high above them. As they rise and fall in their waves, the witness looks, observes, but neither accepts nor for the moment interferes with their course. First, there must be the freedom of the impersonal witness. Afterwards, there can be the control of the master, the Ishwara. The initial advantage of this process of detachment is that one begins to understand one's own nature and all nature. The detached witness is able to see entirely, without the least blinding by egoism, the play of her modes of the ignorance, and to pursue it into all its ramifications, coverings, and subtleties. For it is full of camouflage and disguise and snare and treachery and ruse. Instructed by long experience, conscious of all act and conditions as their interaction, made wise of their processes, he cannot any longer be overcome by their assaults, surprised in their nets, or deceived by their disguises. At the same time, he perceives the ego to be nothing better than a device and the sustaining knot of that interaction, and perceiving it, he is delivered from the illusion of the lower egoistic nature. He escapes from the sattvic egoism of the altruist and the saint and the thinker. He shakes off from its control on his life impulses the rajasic egoism of the self-seeker and ceases to be the laborious caterer of self-interest and the pampered prisoner or toiling galley slave of passion and desire. He slays with the light of knowledge the tamasic egoism of the ignorant or passive being, dull, unintelligent, attached to the common round of human life. Thus convinced and conscious of the essential vice of the ego sense in all our personal action, he seeks no longer to find a means of self-correction and self-liberation in the rajasic or sattvic ego, but looks above, beyond the instruments and the workings of nature, to the master of works alone and his supreme shakti, the supreme prakriti. There alone all the being is pure and free and the rule of a divine truth possible. In this progression, the first step is a certain detached superiority to the three modes of nature. The soul is inwardly separated and free from the lower prakriti, not involved in its coils, indifferent and glad above it. Nature continues to act in the triple round of her ancient habits. Desire, grief, and joy attack the heart. The instruments fall into inaction and obscurity and weariness. Light and peace come back into the heart and mind and body. But the soul stands unchanged and untouched by these changes. Observing and unmoved by the grief and desire of the lower members, smiling at their joys and their strainings, regarding and unoverpowered by the failing and the darknesses of the thought and the wildness or the weaknesses of the heart and nerve, uncompelled and unattached to the mind's illuminations and its relief and sense of ease or of power in the return of light and gladness. It throws itself into none of these things, but waits, unmoved, for the intimations of a higher will and the intuitions of a greater luminous knowledge. Thus, doing always, it becomes eventually free, even in its nature parts, from the strife of the three modes and their insufficient values and imprisoning limits. For now, this lower prakriti feels progressively a compulsion from a higher shakti. The old habits, to which it clung, receive no further sanction and begin steadily to lose their frequency and force of recurrence. At last it understands that it is called to a higher action and a better state, and however slowly, however reluctantly, with whatever initial or prolonged ill will and stumbling ignorance, it submits, turns, and prepares itself for the change. The static freedom of the soul, no longer witness only and knower, is crowned by a dynamic transformation of the nature. The constant mixture, the uneven operation of the three modes acting upon each other in our three instruments, ceases from its normal confused, troubled, and improper action and movement. Another action becomes possible, commences, grows, culminates, a working more truly right, more luminous, natural, and normal, to the deepest divine interplay of Purusha and Prakriti, although supernatural and supernormal to our present imperfect nature. The body, conditioning the physical mind, insists no longer on its tamasic inertia that repeats always the same ignorant movement. It becomes a passive field and instrument of a greater force and light. It responds to every demand of the spirit's force, holds and supports every variety and intensity of new divine experience. It becomes a passive field and instrument of a greater force and light. It responds to every demand of the spirit's force, holds and supports every variety and intensity of new divine experience. Our kinetic and dynamic vital parts, our nervous and emotional and sensational and volitional being, expand in power and admit a tireless action and a blissful enjoyment of experience, but learn at the same time to stand on a foundation of wide, self-possessed and self-poised calm, sublime in force, divine in rest, neither exulting and excited, nor tortured by sorrow and pain, neither harried by desire and importunate impulses, nor dulled by incapacity and indolence. The intelligence, the thinking, understanding, and reflective mind renounces its sattvic limitations and opens to an essential light and peace. An infinite knowledge offers to us its splendid ranges, a knowledge not made up of mental constructions, not bound by opinion and idea or dependent on a stumbling, uncertain logic and the petty support of the senses, but self-sure, authentic, all-penetrating, all-comprehending, a boundless bliss and peace, not dependent on deliverance from the hampered strenuousness of creative energy and dynamic action, not constituted by a few limited felicities, but self-existence and all-including, pour into ever-enlarging fields and through ever-widening and always more numerous channels to possess the nature, a higher force, bliss, and knowledge from a source beyond mind and life and body, seize on them to remold in a diviner image. Here, the disharmonies of the triple mode of our inferior existence are overpassed, and there begins a greater triple mode of a divine nature. There is no obscurity of tamas or inertia. Tamas is replaced by a divine peace and tranquil eternal repose, out of which is released from a superior matrix of calm concentration, the play of action and knowledge. There is no rajasic kinesis, no desire, no joyful and sorrowful striving of action, creation and possession, no fruitful chaos of troubled impulse. Rajas is replaced by a self-possessed power and illimitable active force that even in its most violent intensities does not shake the immovable poise of the soul or stain the vast and profound heavens and luminous abysses of its peace. There is no constructing light of mind casting about to seize and imprison the truth, no insecure or inactive ease. Sattva is replaced by an illumination and a spiritual bliss, identical with the depth and infinite existence of the soul and instinct with a direct and authentic knowledge that springs straight from the veiled glories of the secret omniscience. This is the greater consciousness into which our inferior consciousness has to be transformed. This nature of the ignorance with its unquiet, unbalanced activity of the three modes changed into this greater luminous supernature. At first we become free from the three gunas, detached, untroubled, nistraigunya. But this is the recovery of the native state of the soul, the self, the spirit, free and watching in its motionless calm the motion of prakriti and her force of the ignorance. If on this basis the nature, the motion of prakriti, is also to become free, it must be, by a quiescence of action, in a luminous peace and silence, in which all necessary movements are done without any conscious reaction or participation or initiation of action by the mind or by the life being, without any ripple of thought or eddy of the vital parts. It must be done under the impulsion, by the initiation, by the working of an impersonal cosmic or transcendent force. A cosmic mind, life, substance must act, or a pure transcendent self-power and bliss other than our own personal being or its building of nature. This is a state of freedom which can come in the yoga of works through renunciation of ego and desire and personal initiation and the surrender of the being to the cosmic self or to the universal Shakti. It can come in the yoga of knowledge by the cessation of thought, the silence of the mind, the opening of the whole being to the cosmic consciousness, to the cosmic self, the cosmic dynamis, or to the supreme reality. It can come in the yoga of devotion by the surrender of the heart and the whole nature into the hands of the all-blissful as the adored master of our existence. But the culminating change intervenes by a more positive and dynamic transcendence. There is a transference or transmutation into a superior spiritual status, trigunatita, in which we participate in a greater spiritual dynamization. For the three lower unequal modes pass into an equal triune mode of eternal calm, light, and force, the repose, kinesis, illumination of the divine nature. This supreme harmony cannot come except by the cessation of egoistic will and choice and act and the quiescence of our limited intelligence. The individual ego must cease to strive, the mind fall silent, the desire will learn not to initiate. Our personality must join its source, and all thought and initiation come from above. The secret master of our activities will be slowly unveiled to us, and from the security of the supreme will and knowledge, give the sanction to the divine Shakti, who will do all works in us with the purified and exalted nature for her instrument. The individual center of personality will be only the upholder of her works here, the recipient and channel, the reflector of her power and luminous participator in her light, joy, and force. Acting, it will not act, and no reaction of the lower prakriti will touch it. The transcendence of the three modes of nature is the first condition. Their transformation, the decisive step of this change, by which the way of works climbs out of the pit of narrowness of our darkened human nature into the unwalled wideness of the truth and light above us. End of chapter 10.